Welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today we visit the Maine Irish Heritage Center in Portland for a meeting of the Our Exchange of Portland. We'll hear a speech by Stuart Wallace of the New Economics Foundation, his topic, The Great Transition Toward an Economy That Produces Good Jobs for Everyone, Improves Human Well-Being, and Decreases Social Inequality, and does all this within planetary limits. Mr. Wallace is introduced by Richard Rockefeller, a member of the Board of Directors of Our Exchange Portland.
It's my pleasure now to introduce my friend and colleague, Stuart Wallace, who's, he objected a little bit to it being called a world-renowned economist up front. I think that's because he considers himself more of a recovering economist. But in fact, Stuart is very well known and is highly accomplished in many areas. He worked in East Africa with the World Bank and got a great deal done for people there. He worked for Oxfam and received awards for his work, and is the first and only so far executive director of the New Economics Institute in London, which has not only really posed significant challenges to the status quo economic thinking, but accomplished stimulated results that probably pose an even greater challenge, because standard economists say that a lot of the things that new economists believe in, they say fine, but you can't do it. And when we can do it, it changes the paradigm bit by bit. So anyway, with that, I would like to welcome Stuart.
Thank you so much, and it's great to be here. And one thing I'm really sad about is that I'm only here for a very short time, but I've got to go back to England tomorrow. But I made one promise. I'm going to take the English weather you're having back with me, so I'm going to work on that, okay? What I want to tell you about tonight is why we need a total transformation of our economy, and why it's the problem. And it's going to be a tale of two halves. The first part, I make you gloomy. And please keep staying. Don't walk out of that point, because I'd be worried about you. Then we get to the positive news. And basically, it is positive, but we have to look at what's happening and see why we need that change. And we're calling it a great transition. We need a total change to our economics. But before I get into economics, and it's... You have to bear with me. I am a recovering economist, and I'll try not to do too much tech stuff, but do wave things or throw things if I do. I want to start, though, with that humble rodent, the hamster, that's a favorite cuddly household pet. Now, pretty unknown fact, and this is part of the useless information I've got my brain stuffed with, a hamster doubles its weight every week from birth to puberty. But very luckily, it stops at puberty, doesn't grow anymore. If it carried on growing at that same rate, at 1 year old, it would weigh 9 billion tons. And it would eat every day the whole world's grain supply. And the reason I tell that little fable is because certain things are impossible. There was a quote from an earlier economist who said, anybody who believes that we can have infinite growth in a finite world is either a fool or an economist. And unfortunately, there's quite a lot who fit in both categories. So what I'm going to talk about is what's wrong. And one of the ways I'm going to sum it up is four U's. The world we're living in and the economic system is unsustainable. It's unfair, it's unstable, and it's making us unhappy. Those four things. Now, start with the unsustainable. Put very simply, we as a species are running out of planet. The planet will survive, but in terms of what we use from it, that won't. And it's not just we're using too much of the atmosphere's holding capacity for carbon dioxide, though that's true, and at the minute we're on path for about a 4 degrees temperature rise compared to pre-industrial levels, which will cause all sorts of problems. So it's not surprising that the degrees of storms, floods, what's happening in the Mississippi now, we can't prove that's all connected, but it's quite likely to be. I wouldn't like to take the bet the other way. We don't know yet, but we know we're setting ourselves up for trouble. More New Orleans, more Katrinas. But it's not just climate. Everybody thinks that's the main problem, that's what we hear. But actually, we're running out of fish stocks. The bee population is declining dramatically, and with it, pollination systems. Coral reefs are being degraded. Fresh water is becoming scarcer and scarcer, and we're likely to have wars in the future about fresh water. And we've had some already in some parts of the world. So whichever way you look at it, the life support systems, the very things we depend on for our survival as a species, as humans, are being degraded. And there's a very crude term about how many planets' worth of resources we're using. And if you're using one planet's worth of resources as a planet, it means that you're just about regenerating the planet's resources each year. You're just about using up what the planet can put back for us. Because there's very, the natural resource systems are very good at regenerating themselves if they're not too messed around with. Back in 1980, or about 1983, we were using, as humankind, one planet's worth of resources. Now, we're using about 1.4 planets' worth of resources. We've nearly gone up 50% just in those 30 years. So it's massively fast change, dramatically fast change. And that's serious. And if we carry on as we are, it's incredibly serious. If everybody lived and consumed at the rate Americans do, and that's consuming, not just consuming, but it's consuming non-renewable materials, resources of whatever type, we would need five planets. If everybody consumed at my country's level, we'd need three planets. Of course, we've only got one. So we're in a serious place where we're running down our earthly overdraft in a massive way and not repaying the gift that we're given by nature in any way that anybody would see as reciprocal at all. That's the unsustainable. What about the unfair? Well, at the beginning of the 20th century, the ratio between the top fifth of humankind, the richest fifth of humankind, and the poorest fifth of humankind was about 7 to 1. So the richest fifth were about 7 times richer than the poorest fifth on the planet at the beginning of the 20th century. At the end of the 20th century, it was 75 to 1. A massive, huge shift. So what you can see is these aren't just little incremental shifts on either how we're using up our planet or what's happening to inequality. These are exponential shifts that are going up far more rapidly than you'd expect, and something totally different from human history beforehand. We've done something very different in the last 120, 150 years than we've ever done before as a species. And obviously, these things are made worse by the fact that population is going to grow by about another 3 billion people on the planet, but everybody says it's population. Well, it is a problem. Wouldn't pretend otherwise. But you've got to realize that the average American consumes about 100 times the resources that the average Ethiopian does. So it's not just about the numbers of people on the planet, it's also about how much they're consuming. And that consuming amount is actually a much bigger factor than the sheer numbers. But going back to the unfairness, another way of putting it is over the last 25 years, there's been an increase in wealth for Americans. And of that increase in wealth, 80% has gone to how many, what proportion of the American population? What do you think? The top 1%. 80% to just 1%. Or another way of putting it, the 400 richest Americans are as rich as the 155 million poorer Americans at the bottom of the income scale. That's what we're looking at. We're looking at not just something a little bit out of kilter. And you know, there's this wonderful phrase, trickle down, that's used about economics. The idea is, you know, the rising tide will take up all boats. Well, actually, forget that analogy. It's been a very good one that's been sold to you. Forget the tide taking up the boats. Think more of a Hoover and what's being hoovered up from all of you. That's what's happening. It's a Hoover up, not a trickle down. That's what's going on. So you really need to see it. Think of that. Think of Hoover now. So that's the unfair bit. What about the unstable bit? Well, any natural system is designed by nature to be both resilient and efficient. It needs to be both. Both those things are normal. We've designed our economics, foolishly, just to be efficient. So you make things just in time. You have everything connected electronically, so what happens in one place shoots across to somewhere else. And it's a very unstable system. It's like electricity without the fuse box. And so it's not surprising that a subprime crisis in the Midwest of the US has rippled across the financial system and nearly caused the ATM machines to close down in Europe or other parts of the world. It's not surprising we keep getting more and more currency crises, because the whole thing has been designed for efficiency and not resilience. And as a result, it's neither. It's not efficient to keep falling over. And some of you may know why San Francisco burnt down in the 1904 earthquake. I think it was 1904. It was because, at those days, it was more cost-effective to fill up the fire hydrants. You call them fire hydrants here? These tanks you put in the middle of the block intersections with water in, if the case is a fire. It was cost-effective, they'd worked out, to fill it from one place. That's fine if you just have a fire somewhere. If you have an earthquake, just only needs one bit to rupture, all the water pours out of the whole thing. So when the San Francisco earthquake happened, the whole place, a lot of it burnt down because there was no water. So that was a case where it was more cost-effective to have it all connected, but actually very stupid, and we've learned on that. We don't have all our hydrants filled up separately now. We haven't learned how to do our banking system, our economic system, anything like that. So we need a very different way of looking at it. And lastly, that issue of unhappy. And this is the bit that's really silly. Because not only are we doing all those difficult things, actually we're not making ourselves any happier. And that's daft when you think of it. If you actually look at measures of well-being or happiness for America over the last 40 years, they've gone down. In my own country, they've flatlined. And for many people on the planet, more and better are part of company. More income isn't equaling better lives. For many people, it does. If you're poor or something, of course it does. But if you're past a certain income level, it's not that huge. More income does not necessarily mean better lives or greater happiness. The connection's different. So when you start adding it all up, we're running faster and faster. I sometimes think of an analogy like a hamster wheel whizzing round and round. Burning up our planet as we go, causing lots of unfairness, and that unfairness doesn't just translate into just something that's a bit awkward. There's huge amounts of evidence that the degree of unfairness, inequality, leads to more social problems. So those societies that are more unfair have more crime, more drugs problems, more unwanted teenage pregnancies. You name the problem, they have it. And America is one of the most unfair of the richer nations, and it's not surprising there are serious social problems. Those things tie to each other. So we're running faster and faster, burning up our planet, causing all these social problems and unfairness, having a system that keeps falling over, which is pretty scary because people don't know whether they're going to lose their jobs or whatever happens, and it's not even making us any happier. Now that's really stupid, isn't it? That's the bad news. We're in a very stupid place. And it comes down to economics. And I think Bill Clinton should have said, Instead of his famous soundbite, "It's the economy, stupid," what he should have said, "It's the economy that's stupid, stupid." And that's what I certainly would say. And I won't go into all the reasons why that's so, but there's all sorts of myths that have been promulgated by economists because they'd like it to be a scientific discipline, and so the real world gets tailored to fit the equations rather than the other way around. It's not a mathematical discipline. Maths has got its use. It's not a science, economics. It's a social and political discipline. It's about how humans behave. It's about what we all want in our lives. It's about our meaning in our lives. But it can't just all be measured by equations. So all these things like markets are fair. No, they're not. Markets are only fair if everybody's got roughly equal power. And, you know, something gets trotted out. You've probably heard this word, the invisible hand, which was something that was in The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. It actually appears just once, talking about a bakery. And he actually argues the invisible hand can only work if people are moral. Well, of course, we're not all moral. And the only invisible hand, I think, that really works now is the one that might have been in your back pocket, taking your wages or your pensions. And some of the banks have quite a good invisible hand. So that's one thing. Another is that prices tell the truth. Prices do not tell the ecological truth. There was somebody who was a very senior executive called Øystein Dahl, who worked for ExxonMobil, who had a flash of truth. And he said, communism collapsed because it didn't allow prices to tell the economic truth, because they distorted a central market. Capitalism will collapse because it doesn't allow prices to tell the ecological truth, the real truth about what we're using up on the planet. Now, I hope he's wrong, but that's what he said. So, all sorts of myths. Money will make us happier. Past a certain point, it won't. We should discount future investments. Actually, you need to not discount our grandchildren. So, there's all these myths in economics which seriously need changing. Our economics, let's put it simply, is both intellectually and morally bankrupt, especially our macroeconomics. It's that serious. We've got it messed up. So that's why Richard says I'm a recovering economist. I'm not sure I've fully recovered yet, but I'm working on it hard. What do we need? So let's assume I've depressed you enough. I could go on, but I won't. What do we need? It's fairly simple at one level. We want an economy that is focused on improving the quality of our life. Some people use the term well-being. We want an economy that creates enough good jobs. And good jobs mean not something that's paid below the living wage and state health, Medicare, and things has to pay. I'm not sure I get my whichever one's the one for under people on low income, has to pick up the wages of people working in Walmart, not the wages, the health care of people in Walmart. We want good jobs. That means good jobs that are interesting, not too stressful, reasonably well paid. That sounds a bit of a nirvana, but that's what we want. We want a fairer society. We want more equality. And we want to do that all within fair ecological or planetary means. It means that we here in this country, we in England, mustn't be using up more than our fair share of planetary resources. So it's about not just ecological limits at planet level, but it's about our fair share of them. Now that's pretty obvious goals. That's nothing, it's pretty common sense. That's what you want an economy to deliver. Is it designed to do that now? Of course it isn't. There's this idea that it should just be designed to increase GDP. And Robert Kennedy years ago said about gross domestic product, or GDP, it measures everything apart from our love for our families, the natural wealth of the nation. In fact, and I won't quote it all, but he ends on saying it measures everything except that that makes life worthwhile. And it's a useful measure. As an economist, I wouldn't rubbish it totally, but it's like the speedo on your car, and it would help to be able to see out of the front where you're going and have sense of where you want to get to. would help to be able to look out of the rearview mirror and learn a bit. It would help to know if you're running out of fuel, you're using up the resources of the planet too much. It would help to know if you're overheating and about things about to crash. We don't have, you know, we expect all those things in a car. We can manage those different bits of information. We ought to have that on our economics. We don't. So the first thing one needs to do is measure the right things. Measure our well-being. Aim to look at doing that and say, we want to know if our quality of life is going up or down. And that's what we hold our politicians responsible for. Measure the degree of equality in society. That's what we hold them responsible for. Measure their ability to create jobs, because GDP's recovered after the crash in America. Jobs certainly haven't. So those things matter. So measuring the right things is the first thing. Second thing is start taxing the things that are bad. If we're worried about using too much raw materials, too much things that are harming the planet, pollutants, we should tax them higher and take the tax off labor. Take the tax off value added. So businesses that are working on renewables would make very good profits. People, you know, you should be taxing the things that are harmful and not taxing the things that increase our well-being, like jobs and incomes. That would be another crucial thing you could do. You need to regulate, and it's interesting, the best businesses like regulation. This isn't anti-business. It just doesn't suit some people who the current system suits very well. So the American car companies fought so blooming hard to keep away from environmental regulation for so long that what they managed to do is make themselves like dinosaurs that became extinct. They couldn't, when the Chinese market opened up, they couldn't compete there, because the Chinese set higher standards than the American auto companies have been living by. The Japanese cleaned up. It's not even good business. It's stupid. So we need to regulate. We need companies that reflect all sorts of different models: employee-owned, mutuals, co-ops. And we need to move from a shareholder ownership model to a stakeholder ownership model, but one where you have different people who are involved in the business, the employees, all sorts of people. You need to give a good rate of return on capital to the people putting money in. I'm not against that at all. You need to do that, but you need also to look after the interests of the people who work there, the community they work in, the environment it works in. Again, it's common sense, and some of the best companies are talking that way. And furthermore, there's been this myth peddled by business schools, and I went to business school, which is the purpose of a business is to improve long-term earnings per shareholder income. That's a pretty boring thing to do, and it doesn't motivate people, even the people who work in that business. The purpose of the business is to provide a good service or something that matters to people, or a good car or whatever else it might be, and they have to make some money to do it. But we've got means and ends all the time muddled up. So businesses that work for the whole community, and doing business and doing good should not be different. And at the minute, there's still the model: you do your business, you work in a certain way there, you go back and you act in a very different way in your family, and you earn your wealth and then you give it away. Well, actually, that's good that you give it some of it away, but it'd be much better if doing business and doing good were the same. And we need to change it so that that's made much more possible. And lots of people in business want that. It's just the rules don't allow them to at the minute. We want banks, now don't laugh too much here, want banks that are our servants, that are here to serve us. We want money to be the servant, not the master. And we want banks that are stable, that are fair, that really reach out to the poorest in communities, and which are socially useful. Is that too much to ask? And it's interesting, I'm on a group with somebody who's the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, and it's appropriate in this hall, because Ireland has been one of the cases where the banks have done more harm than can be possibly imagined. We think it's bad in this country, we think it's bad in my country, and let's be clear, the banks, you know, what's being now sold as excess government expenditure might have been a bit of that, and there certainly wasn't nearly enough government regulation. But it's been what was actually happened was this was a crisis that happened 2 years, 3 years ago, caused by the banks doing crazy things, just gambling with our money. So what was a banking crisis has transformed into a public expenditure crisis. It's not a public expenditure crisis, it's a banking crisis, and we're not dealing with it. And this Catholic Archbishop of Dublin told me a really funny joke that's going around the church circles in Ireland. Apparently, every year, the Irish bankers, all the top heads of the Irish banks, used to go to the World Economic Forum, which is a big summit in Davos in Switzerland, on the same plane. And there used to be endless articles in the newspapers saying, isn't this desperately dangerous for the Irish economy? They're traveling together, you know, and it used to be they ought to be taking separate planes. Well, the joke now going around the Catholic Church in Ireland, according to the Archbishop, is why didn't God strike when he had the chance? A bit mean, but that's the Archbishop today. So. And then what we need is we need local food, local energy, community energy supplies, community banks. We need to be investing our pension locally because this is where we live and work. We need, so, local pensions. We need things, the right things at the local level, but we also need still to be operating in the global society. So it's not pull the drawbridge up and we'll be okay and forget those people in Africa. It has to be an interdependent society, but those things we can do here, we should do here. But we also need to trade fairly on things that we need to buy, and we also need to recognize that we owe a debt to the poorest people on the earth. You know, everybody's focused on the debt they owe us for money. We owe an ecological debt because we've used up much of the planetary resources. We owe that to them. So this isn't about being nice or charitable. It's about actually recognizing our commitment to our fellow humans. So, and those things will still require a market, businesses. It's not a change, dramatic change in the system, but it's setting out to say, what do we want? And it's, at one level, much more power locally, but another level, it's a much smarter government. It's not big government or small government. It's about smart government, strategic government, that actually says, works with business, works with people locally to say, where do we want to go? And it's not so daft to say, as a country, where do we want to go? Countries like Denmark, ages ago, said, we want to be a world leader in wind power, because they're a windy, small nation off in the North Sea. They were very wise. They are a world leader in wind power, and they've done very well from that. And rather than saying we must protect what we've got, we should be saying, what do we want as Americans? Where do we want to go? So you might say dream on, and I'd say you're absolutely right. Back to Martin Luther King, and I had a dream. Dreams are absolutely vital. We've all got a dream. We've got a dream and make those dreams a reality. So I absolutely agree. Let's dream on. It's obvious what we need as an economy. This is what we've got to get. Now we move to the good news. There is real hope. Let's start with actually what's already happening right here in the USA. Let's even start with what's happening right here in Portland. The R Exchange, Time Bank, R Exchange Portland, which is put this event on, is now one of the largest time banks anywhere in the world. And it works on a incredibly simple concept that whether I'm an eye surgeon or a lawyer or somebody who's unemployed, my hour, my time is worth as much as yours. And it works on the idea that people may not have money, but they have time, they have talent, and we've all got talent. And we can exchange that and we can help each other. And it's a very fundamental principle based on equality, and it's a very empowering principle. So what's happened here in Portland is 25,000 hours has been exchanged to give people who couldn't afford healthcare, healthcare. A large number of homes have been winterized. People on low income have been helped. The young have been helping the old have been helping the young. And it's a brilliant system. In total, something like 150,000 hours have been exchanged. That's massive. And that doesn't come into the economy. It doesn't turn up on the GDP balance sheet at all. But it's about creating wealth. It's about creating connections. It's about people getting to know each other. And it's about people giving and receiving. That's about being human. That's right here. And it's phenomenal. The Schumacher Society, that's a partner of my organization in London, the New Economics Foundation, has been working in the Berkshires, and it's created a complementary currency as well as all sorts of exchange, local food exchanges and all sorts of things. But it's got now $2 million of complementary currency called the Berkshires in circulation. The banks buy and sell it. You can exchange your greenback for it. So it's already happening, and that means people buy local and get a premium for buying local, and people trade locally. That makes a difference. And there's even a bit of a talk at the minute to get the police department to take Berkshires in fines. We haven't got there yet, but it'll happen. There's a transition town movement that started in the UK and is now really happening in many towns in this country. And transition towns is all about people saying, how do we make our own community sustainable? How do we make it carbon neutral? How do we make it so its footprint on the earth is much lighter? And then there's this wonderful project that's happening right in downtown Cleveland. And the point about this is not just a nice-to-do pastime for relatively wealthy people. These sort of things are happening in some of the poorest, most difficult communities, as well as some of the wealthiest communities. This is about being human beings. And in Cleveland, probably some of you know, with all the industrial crash, the population of Cleveland has gone down from 900,000 to 300,000. Just think about that for a second. And those jobs have gone, and the people remaining, it's like a wasteland. Well, I better just drink some water, because I can see I'm talking too much. And what's happened is they realize that it's no use just relying on government schemes and handouts, because already, right there in Cleveland, there's a phenomenal buying power that wasn't being used, and that's the hospital, that's the schools. Hospitals buying massive amounts of vegetables from where? California and places. Now, when you're sitting there in Cleveland with no jobs, why aren't those jobs going locally? And that's what's happened. A whole lot of workers' co-ops have been set up, and they're big scale, and they're providing services to the hospital, to the city, to the schools, to all those things. And what's being built at the minute is the biggest urban greenhouse anywhere here in the USA, a hydroponic greenhouse, which will grow masses of vegetables for the hospital, for the schools, and all sorts of fresh food. One of the biggest solar suppliers is again another co-op that's supplying, putting solar panels on all the roofs in Cleveland. There's a laundry that's like an industrial-scale laundry owned by the people who work in it, again as a co-op, which is doing all the laundry, the sheets for the hospital, for the all sorts of other institutions, the nursing homes, all those things in Cleveland. And that's providing employment, hope, for those people in the inner city who didn't have it, and it's revitalizing the city. That's what New Economics is about. It's about taking things into our own hands. So right here, probably 6% of the American economy is already what I would call a new economy. It's happening. But then let me just talk about my country, the UK, because my organization, the New Economics Foundation, has been now working for about 25 years. And Richard, I'm now the second director, and we had lots of coordinators before. So we went around on empty for about 10 years and then managed to get a director, and I'm now the second one. We call ourselves very inelegantly but accurately a think and do tank, because we're one of the biggest research and policy outfits in the UK. We're 50 people plus all sorts of interns and people in universities and partners. But we also we work in communities and we do practical stuff. So we try and learn from both. And we have been working for a long time on measuring well-being. And you can measure well-being. It's not an airy-fairy thing. It's actually very measurable. You have to ask people a lot of questions, and you have to do it the proper way. But roughly 50% of our well-being as a human, roughly 40% of our well-being as a human comes either from our genetic makeup or our first 2 years of life, and nobody knows which one it is, and it's impossible to tell. Another 10%, and it's only 10%, comes from whether we're rich, poor, married, not married, those sort of things. 50% comes from the quality of our relationships with others and whether we feel valuable and valued. And that 50% is amenable to working on, it's amenable to policy, and it's important to measure it. So, for example, we did a survey of about 2,000 school kids in a place in the north of England and looked at girls 15 to 17 year old who were in school, in all sorts of schools, rich, poor again, all sorts of backgrounds, and we looked at those girls that were both doing well in school and had high levels of happiness. And we thought the biggest factor that was in common with those group would be, did they have boyfriends? Or did they have a really good friendship group? Those were important. Or did they come from a relatively well-off family? But none of them were the main factor. It was, were they involved in team activities like sports, art, and music? That was by far the biggest determinant. And if you just think about that for a second, it says one of the most important things you should do is not cut your school music services, not cut your art courses, not cut the sports activities or close down the playing fields that we've done in our country. You should put more resources into those things that give kids and give people, because we're all kids at one level, a sense of being valued and valuable. So we went on to measure these things. We did something called the Happy Planet Index that looked at which countries were creating happy and long lives to their citizens at least cost to the planet. Costa Rica comes out number one because they don't spend any money on the army. They live longer than people do here. They could spend a lot of money on health care. And they live within planetary limits. They live on one planet's level of resources, whereas here we live at five planets' level of resources. So US is, I'm afraid, 144th out of the countries in the world on the Happy Planet Index, and my country's about 101. Not very clever. So when you look at progress that way, we're perhaps going backwards, and other people are doing it better than us. But we went on from that to do the first ever national accounts of well-being in the world across 22 European countries. And now we and others have persuaded our government in the UK to measure not just GDP, but well-being. And that sounds like a bit of a geeky thing, but it's actually terribly important, because what we measure is what matters. And if we start reporting, you know, that GDP has gone up, but people's well-being has gone down, and you hold the government to account, that's starting to tell you a story. So it's desperately important, and we're working in Ecuador and other places. So that's a change that's happened from that research up to the bigger level. We've done lots of work at the local level on community energy and things, but we've then gone on to push the idea of a Green New Deal, tackling the recession by creating green jobs and sort of things that have been talked about here. And actually, Obama's campaign used our term. We came up with that term, Green New Deal, first. And there's been lots of talk in many countries, but not so much action. There's been a lot of greenwash. But that work has led in the UK to what's called feed-in tariffs. If I generate electricity, or a community generates electricity by wind, by renewable means, or by solar, it gets paid not just for what it feeds back into the grid, but also for every kilowatt it generates, which makes that economically viable. Because at the minute, solar panels and wind turbines cost far too much. So just leaving it to the market don't work. You've got to intervene in the market initially to get that technology off the ground. And that's happened. And we've also committed as the British government to serious carbon reduction targets, the first government of the world to do that. Now, the British government's got lots of flaws, but that sort of very practical work, campaigning, research and policy, can lead to changing things that everybody said are impossible to change. That's why I'm going on, not to say we're a great organization, though I obviously believe we are, but because it's possible. And you could change things, not just at the local level, but the national level. Because we've done so much work in my country on creating credit unions and banks, and we've created some ourselves and supported others, we've now seen as one of the organization that's most authoritative around what should happen to the banks. And so we're giving seminars inside the UK Treasury and in the Bank of England, which is a bit of a joke, because normally we'd have been thrown out of the door, you know, as a bit of people who wouldn't be let across the pedestal. But they're listening. I'm not sure they're going to take enough notice, but they're listening. And that really helps as well. And because we've created 1,000 businesses in some of the most deprived areas of the UK, again, people like our business secretary are listening when we talk about industrial strategy and what needs to happen. So that work on the ground needs to be linked to research and policy, which then, and campaigning, which then can enable you to change things at the national level. So these things are possible. And just to give you another little view, there's a place called Luton, in the just north of London, 30 miles north of London. A very poor community on the edge of Luton. It's quite an ethnically diverse community. There's been quite serious riots there. So this is inner city, serious riots. We worked with the local community people, community leaders, to do an exercise in that community, which is seen as one of the poorest in England, to see how much money they really had and what they could do with it. And we sat down with all the community and worked out how much money was coming in and what was going out. And sort of things that came up were they were spending £3 million, or about $4.5 million a year, on takeaway pizzas. And they said, this is stupid. Once we put it together, we'll make our own pizzas. So they set up their own pizza business as a co-op, employs 15 people, makes much nicer pizzas right there on the estate. They said, how much are we spending, is the council spending on our old people or the private company that come in? And they realized they could train up people to do care and bid for the care of their old people. So once you start analyzing, you don't just need to say, I want more money. You need to start saying, what wealth have we already got and what can we do with it? And that's a different take. And similarly, time banks came from the US to the UK, and we helped create them in the UK. But that concept that I talked about earlier on time banks here in Portland has led to some very interesting things happening, which is around the idea of co-production, that you don't think of public services, and it's an awful word, I'm sorry, there's no better word for it at the minute, I want to find one. So if any of you can tell me, please do, answers on a postcard. But what co-production means is that instead of being a patient coming for a medical service, or instead of being a pupil, or instead of being a young person in a young person's service, you are an actor. You have power, you have some role in delivering your own service. So it's not just you're on a board talking about what you want, it's you're actually part of that. And that's turned out to be very powerful because there isn't enough money to go around, and there probably won't ever be, to run all the public services the way we want them. But where we've worked with a number of councils, local authorities in the UK that were going to cut their youth services, for example, and we've said, hang on, don't cut them. Yet the young people have a say about what they could do. And in some cases, they're operating something that's involving those young people and actually running it, doing the back office, doing the computer work, that is not just operating on a smaller budget, it's having much greater results. So it's not, you've got to be careful with this one, because you don't want to just say, give an excuse for money to be cut to public services, but it is a way of giving people more power and more influence. So all those things, I just wanted to give you a flavour that something very different is possible. So anybody who says it's not possible, no, it is possible. And that's why we're working in the UK on something called this Great Transition. And what we're trying to do is take all these ideas, put them together in a compelling story. We're starting off, and if you go to our website, which is www.neweconomics.org, all one word, New Economics. You can see this report, The Great Transition, and download it for free. And it starts off for a vision of how things turned out all right. It looks at 2050 and it shows a society that's a bit like I'm describing. And then it works backwards to how we get there. And what we're trying to do is put this all together and tell a compelling human story about what we want. And what we're also showing is also the economics. So we're showing the economists how you can do that, and we're doing the first ever economic model that starts from ecological limits and works back the other way. That's the nerdy bit. but we're trying to tell the human story. And what we're trying to do is campaign not just with civil society, but with faith groups, with arts organizations. We're looking at a festival transition that is going to involve almost every arts organization in the UK later this year, if we can pull it off. Businesses, because right through society, there's people that know things are wrong and want to change it. So it's about harnessing everybody. It's not about singing exactly the same tune, but and playing the same instrument. You know, 1,000 million tubas would be not great. You know, you might get a bit fed up with tubas. But if we can play our different instruments in one orchestra to one score, then maybe we can create something harmonious. And that's what we're about. And that's why we have focused our work on the Great Transition. And that's why one of the reasons I'm over here, as well as coming up and talking about what's happening here and learning about what's happening here, is because we are working to create something called the New Economics Institute here in America, which is a partnership with that organization in Western Mass, the Schumacher Society, which is aiming to set up something like the New Economics Foundation in London here. And that will be a think, do, and communicate tank. God, that sounds even worse, doesn't it? But it will be doing really good research, doing practical stuff with all sorts of people like you here, and communicating, telling the new story in a way that resonates at the national level. So that's what we're about. That's why I'm here. And we've got a great group of trustees. We've got free offices on Madison Avenue, a great view of the Empire State Building. And we're now trying to get the money for a director and to get that thing going, because we're going to try and be at the heart of the system and tell a different story. So that's what we're doing here. But let me come back to you. And I've talked far too much, and apologies. But the critical thing is, this isn't about an organization in London. It isn't about an organization that we're helping to set up here in New Economics Institute. They're part of the story. But the real story is about yourselves. Because the critical thing I want you to take away tonight is that we all have far much more power than we realize, especially if we work together. So you can do things here in your own community in whatever way, and you don't need to have money to do that. You've got time. If you've got time, you can do something. You can buy very differently. And one of the things that really strikes me, and I get a chance to talk to CEOs of big multinationals, how worried they are about what the people will change, what they do. They'll buy differently. And some of them, the best ones, are planning to do things differently. They're planning to sell less stuff and more services, and that's probably very wise. But they aren't all powerful. They're very dependent on how we use our dollar or our pound. And then the other thing you've got is a voice. And everybody's voice counts. That's, again, independent of how much wealth we've got. So we've got right here your time, your voice, your own purchasing power, the wealth you've got in all sorts of ways. And we've got the chance to go out and create something very different if enough of us work together. And that's my plea to you is, A, do not despair. As I've said before, the hour before dawn can sometimes seem the bleakest and coldest. There will be change. And that change is in our hands. And secondly, believe it's really possible. It is possible. And it's up to all of us to create it. And if enough of us dream the impossible, we can make that impossible possible. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Stuart Wallace of the New Economics Foundation. He spoke at a recent gathering of Our Exchange Portland. You may order a recording of today's program by calling MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. The program will also be available at our website, mpbn.net. Just click on Audio on Demand or Podcasts. You'll also find an archive of many past Speaking in Maine programs as well. That's at mpbn.net.